The Arctic is getting political, and we're all watching it happen. It is the latest invasion of the North, but not the first by any means. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. I'm happy to tell you that we're once again talking to explorers who are ground-truthing this amazing place we live in. Plenty of connections for Alaskans to share on this show at 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. Finding the Arctic by traveling the Arctic Circle, the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
One of the main characters in Charles Woolforth's fascinating book, The Whale and the Supercomputer, is our guest on the show today. And if you've read that book, you probably feel you already know Matthew Stern. But welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks for having me on, Steve. I'm glad to be here.
Matthew works at the Army Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory out at Fort Wainwright, and he joins us from there by telephone. And I called you a ground truther, and I suspect that that's probably what you call yourself.
Yeah, I guess there's a couple ways to experience the Arctic in Alaska, and for some of us, just standing there and actually having our boots on the ground and seeing there's something tactile almost about being there that helps me understand the place much better. And as a scientist, it also helps to sort of be out there. I'm the antithesis of the type of scientist who just does modeling and sits in a laboratory. I have to be there.
And that's very much nicely portrayed, I think, in Charles's book, where he tries to keep up with you as you go out and take your samples.
We enjoyed Charles. That was he had called us and he said he was doing this book, and I said, "Well, we're on a long traverse. We're coming up from Nome by snowmobile, but if you can get yourself to Atkasuk, we can take care of the rest." And that's how my group and I ended up in the book. I didn't actually know him much at that time, and he came out with us, and you know, then when the book came out, there we were. So it was pretty fun that way.
Yeah. Well, now you've got your own book, and once again, you're traveling around in snow machines. And this one's called Finding the Arctic. And this is basically based on a trip that you hustled up in 2007, tracing the Arctic Circle and going all the way from Fairbanks to Hudson Bay.
That's right. You know, the source or the reason for the trip, we had done a whole bunch of long traverses in Alaska, and they were solely driven by science. Snow cover matters a lot in Alaska for a lot of things. Like for oil exploration, you can't get out there until there's enough snow. Caribou interactions with snow are really big. So all these other traverses had been really hardcore. We would, we'd travel along, but we were making a lot of measurements, and several of the folk guys who had been on those trips with me and I started talking. We just kind of felt like it would be really neat to do a trip that sort of had a little different basis, and that's when we started scheming for this trip across the Arctic Circle. And there, the real driver for us, though we were going to do science, was also to hit a lot of villages and do a bunch of outreach. For us, the prize was that route would take us through some wonderful historic spots. So it was kind of, and in the end, the snow measurements were still there, and they were pretty intense, but it was a welcome change from a series of very long trips where, we'd work 12, 14 hours a day making snow measurements, and by the end, everybody said, we got to do a trip that's not quite that intense.
And so you did.
Yeah. So the route, we chose a route Actually, it turns out there's not a lot of ways you can get across Arctic Canada along the Arctic Circle and still get enough gas. So it turns out the choices were more limited than we thought. We started in Fairbanks, and we knew we had to get over to Hudson Bay, and there are a couple things that constrained it. Mainly, you got to figure out, well, where are you going to resupply for gas and food? And then the forested areas are hard to get through, and there's a brush line kind of in the middle between the forest and the tundra. And so you either make a choice to go north and stay in the tundra, which was the one we chose, or south, and then it takes you through lakes and on trail systems. So once we had decided where we started and end, the rest was pretty easy.
Easy is a very relative term here, Matthew.
The hardest thing is there's a very long stretch in Canada where you have to figure out how you're going to deal with your fuel. There have been a couple other groups I know of passed through there, mushers, where the fuel's not an issue. Snowmobilers, including the famous Roger Siglin, who's done some really long trips where they used really small snowmobiles that can't pull much, but are pretty parsimonious about fuel. In our case, we put a fuel cache in with the help of the two Canadian partners on this. That was probably the single biggest logistical hurdle, and then the rest is making sure you got food to eat and maps and nowhere to go.
Yeah, you had to take sleds behind you. You had to carry a bunch of gear because you were doing your scientific measurements. And as I recall, you also were trying to keep a blog where from time to time you were able to get through, I think, to your daughter who was updating whatever material you had provided to that blog.
Yeah, actually, it was Dave Anderson, one of the guys who had traveled with Siglin, we called him our base camp manager. He was here in Fairbanks, and he was updating the blog, and much thanks to Dave. Yeah, the blogging turned out to be the hardest thing I was doing on the trip. So we would travel all day. He'd get up in the morning, and that was often leisurely, but we were trying to get off by 9 o'clock, which in the cold is pretty good. Drive all day. Maybe it's 8 or 9 o'clock at night. We'd start to camp. And at that point, you had to figure out, well, what am I going to blog for the day? And it's cold. So I had an IBM computer, and it turned out it wouldn't start unless I'd take the hard drive out every morning, and I'd stick it in. I wore a kidney belt, nice kind of rubbery thing, and you'd stick it down in there. So by the time we arrived in camp, the hard drive at least was warm, even if the computer was cold-soaked. Then as the other guys were getting tents and stuff, I'd start trying to think, all right, we saw all sorts of neat stuff, but you're a little bit brain dead by then.
Yeah. I mean, you're sitting on a snow machine all day, for Pete's sake.
Yeah, so you're thinking, so there was a certain amount of discussion in camp, like, well, we saw a moose or something, and then you'd try and get the blog out. And even if you got that, the actual, getting pictures and text out over, sat phone was it's getting easier, but it was still complicated. And I remember some miserable nights sort of, in the tent trying to find the satellite reception so it would work, pictures that wouldn't go down. But it turned out people were following us and really in enjoying it. And so in the end, I was very happy we did the blogs. And I think in a way that led directly to writing the book, Finding the Arctic.
Yeah. Well, I did want to get a little kind of a feel for some of the logistics and weirdness of it. I mean, and it's in the winter, and the temperature is typically somewhat below zero, right, throughout the trip?
Yeah, usually around minus 20 or something, which sounds cold, but that's pretty tolerable. We didn't have a lot of really bitterly cold weather.
And in those temperatures, you get certain things that you can kind of count on, like the way that the ice is going to look on a lake. Those ice crystals that are often in the air. So you get, stuff that you're pretty used to, but is probably exotic to a lot of people listening to this program.
Yeah, it's the winter world, and because I'm in Alaska and we've got mushers, a lot of Alaskans have a really close connection with winter, and so it doesn't seem that exotic. But for many of your listeners, it's a very white world. When we're in the taiga forests, it's white plus the dark green of the taiga. Once you're out on the barren lands or the tundra, it's pretty much a white world with a blue sky if you're lucky. You get a lot of beautiful atmospheric effects, ice crystals in the, you know, diamond dust in the air that makes the air sparkle. And, you know, the snow is your constant companion, and it's got a thousand faces. It's, you know, there's drifted snow and soft snow. And in addition, the snow is making noises, interacting with how you walk or your snowmobiles and stuff like that. So interestingly enough, the cold is actually your friend. You know, super cold, really nasty cold, minus 40 and below is bad. Machines don't like that. But anything up, you know, around minus 20 and above to about zero is, humans, we do really well in it, and the machines do pretty well. We have equally bad trouble when it's getting up near freezing. Now the snow's sticky and everything's starting to get wet. So there's kind of an optimal temperature range in there where it's not too cold, but it's not, you're not going to melt snow on your gear, your tents, or other things like that. And, you know, that world, it takes some getting used to because it's a bit of a monocolor world, you know, white and blue, or if there's storms, it's just white on white. But there's lots to see there and lots of subtle beauty in the snow cover.
There's two characters. I mean, clearly you have the members of your expedition, and we could fill a book and an hour talking about them. But I don't want to. I want to talk about the land, the geography, but also what you found most important was the people.
Yeah, that's right.
I think this is, to start with, you know, because you traveled through so much history, we might want to pick a couple of examples where you felt it was really the personification of change coming to the Arctic. And one of them would be the Mad Trapper thing.
Sure, it's a great character to talk about. You know how the Arctic has changed. Steve, it might be worth maybe me taking just a second to sketch the geography real quick for people.
Please do. Yeah, I mean, what stands out in my head is that it's all glacier scraped. Once you get past the hills, it's all what you call barren lands.
Yeah, I would separate into two things. So the trip was about 2,500 miles starting in Fairbanks. And so in Fairbanks, we're starting in the taiga forests, which for people who don't live in the taigas, kind of stunted spruces, aspens, and, you know, willows. It's a forest, but it's not the towering forests of the Pacific Northwest. And about half the trip was in the taiga forests. And through the taiga forests, you by and large drive on the rivers. They're the highways through the taiga forest. So that's a world of forests and river. And then we went through a distinct change. We traveled on the rivers. We traveled, you know, down the Yukon and then up the Porcupine. Then we traversed over the Richardson Mountains, put you on the Mackenzie River, but that's still the taiga, so you're still traveling in these forests. Once we got to Great Bear Lake, we transited to what are called the Barren Lands, where the glaciers have scraped things off. And that's a world with, other than a few stunted willows, mostly rock and snow cover and tundra, you know, and it's been scraped and gnarled up by the glaciers. And the second half then was traveled there, and that's a world of great, huge lakes. The eighth biggest lake in the world, Great Bear Lake, but also many lakes people probably never heard of, like Almer Lake, that are more than 100 miles long, and if they were in the lower 48, would be famous. So that was kind of the landscape. It kind of had two parts, the taiga first and then the tundra barrenlands second. And it was when we crossed the Richardson Mountains that we were on the track of the Mad Trapper. So if you want, we can talk a bit about him. He was what an interesting character, huh?
Yeah, that comes back over and over again the native people of the North are usually fairly sparsely populated and getting along quite well with their a very severe environment. But man, some of those white people that came up there are just crazy as loons.
Yes. Well,
so John Franklin is the famous example, and you really spell out, I mean, here's this guy that is in the whole British class system and he screws up one way after another. And finally dies of it, but he almost died of it the first time he went up there, and then it becomes a cause celeb to go find this guy, you know, led by his wife and all this publicity and so forth. So that's one of those high publicity things that happened. And John Franklin, by the way, you know, there's a bust of Franklin in front of the Anchorage Library with no plaque on it of any sort. It just seems appropriate, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does seem, well, so for the listeners, so John Franklin was a British explorer, famous because he and his ships were lost in the Canadian Arctic in the 1840s. But much earlier than that, he actually did an exploration overland, starting in Canada and traveling through the Voyager river systems. He got himself all the way up to Great Slave Lake. And his goal was actually to explore more of the Inland Passage, the Northwest Passage in the Canadian Archipelago. But the idea was to strike that overland and by coming down the Copper Mine River. I think it was 1821. He comes in there, and they got to Great Slave Lake, and then they penetrated further into the Barren Lands. They're now in this glacially scraped area. And they wintered there on a place called Greenstocking Lake. And then the next spring, they headed north and dragging their boats over the ice. And you have to understand, there were about five or six British seamen led by Franklin. The rest are mixed-blood French-Canadian paddlers, Indians from other parts of Canada. So you had a very distinct class system. The British show up here, but they maintain their Victorian class system. There's very distinct difference between the officers and the men, and which is going to play a big role later in what happens. Franklin works his way north and really is relying on the people, his men, because they hunt. They're living a somewhat subsistence lifestyle. They get all the way to Coronation Gulf with the canoes they're paddling, and here Franklin and the British Navy guys is with come into their own in that I can't even imagine navigating these ocean stretches in birch bark canoes, but they do, and they make it eventually over to east. But at that point, their canoes are pretty much shot, and Franklin makes a fatal mistake, much against the wishes of his men, and decides they'll go overland. And he and his men head out overland, and it turns into a starvation march. The 21 guys that start, I think that's how many, half of them die of starvation. And it has all of the normal macabre stuff of cannibalism and murder and stuff like that. Franklin escapes by the skin of his teeth and becomes known as the man who ate his boots because they were reduced to eating tripe de roche, which is a lichen that occurs on the rocks, and whatever leather goods they had, they would boil those up.
A little flavor.
It's his first debacle, and in the normal world, you would think it would have been his last, but he went back to become a hero in England, leaving quite a few graves out there. We had planned to actually follow as much of his route as we could, just to try and understand what these poor guys were going through when we were out there.
But it was too nasty.
Yeah, we started, the first day we were on his route, and we covered probably what they were covering in several days. We probably covered in one day, and it was pretty good going. We were on, relatively level tundra and moving along. The second day, though, we got into... The best way for the listeners to sort of understand it is just imagine a rock quarry that had just snowed on, with rocks sticking up all over the place and gravel, and that's what it was like snowmobiling through. And we worked our way through that for the better part of a day at great risk to the machines, because you can crunch the skis on a snowmobile in no time if you hit a rock like that. They have carbide skegs that'll just stick on a rock and it'll crumple the running gear. So we were massively impressed, but we were also a little scared for our own equipment. So we bailed out and got on to Yampa Lake at the time and did a detour that would have been unavailable for Franklin. We did see, though, what these poor guys went through. And, as you said, it was a cultural mismatch. Franklin was traveling through a land where starvation was always very prevalent, and just subsisting and surviving was success enough. In his mind, success was being able to go back to England and say, I've discovered new parts of the land, and that was worth dying for. But the people he was with really hadn't signed on for that. So, and ironically, they took the toll. Most of the people who died were either the native hunters or the indigenous people he was traveling with, or the French Canadian voyagers. Oh, only yeah. One of the British actually died at the time.
Right. So then, you know, we obviously you have such great relish for this history, and the Franklin tale is probably well known. But the Mad Trapper that I want you to get to is it was very famous at the time, and then we all forgot.
This is the ultimate. Not everyone's forgotten, but a lot of people don't know about him.
It's the ultimate end of the rotor story.
Yeah, we think, you know, the people who sort of show up today, and you know, and unfortunately in years past, the end of the rotors. You know, there's been some famous murders in Alaska, and Manly, and at Kennecott, and stuff like that. But it actually, there's a lot of precedent for it. I think it helped, too. It was the Depression. For the Mad Trapper now, we sort of shift to 1930s. You know, it's in a Depression, and a lot of young guys were on the road in the lower 48, and in Canada there wasn't a lot of work. And so they drifted north, and I think it sort of, people heard the word, oh, you could, you know, it was a land of milk and plenty, and you could trap and make a living and hunt, and it would all be good. And one of the many people who sort of drifted north with a guy who ultimately got known as the Mad Trapper. We don't really know who he was. All we know is that he sort of appeared around Fort McPherson in 1930s, and went out on a trap line on the Rat River and immediately got himself crosswise with the native guys who were trapping that river. And that led to what turned out to be the greatest manhunt of the time. So if you want, I can kind of sketch the story for the readers for the listeners who haven't heard it much.
Yeah, I think I'd like you to do that, but I'd like to also point out that what you found fascinating about this, along with retracing a lot where all this happened, was that this is like the very earliest aircraft in Alaska, which played a critical role in this, and this is maybe the last person who had some kind of realistic prospect and almost made it of going out into the wilderness and vanishing, disappearing.
Yeah, that's a great point, Steve. You know, the Alaska from first contact with Westerners on, there was no communication. It took months to travel somewhere. You could just disappear if you wanted to, and you know it. Because of the slow speed with which things traveled, it was basically the speed of canoes on rivers or dog mushing, and the vast areas that were open, it was possible to just disappear into the north. But World War I was already making inroads on that. You know, basically technology was coming along. The radio had already been invented. Radio and telegraph were already in the north. Airplanes were coming to the north. It was taking them some time because, you know, the rigors of the north, you know, the first airplanes were not all that good. I mean, it was hard to keep them running. But by 1930, aircraft are actually working, and as we'll get to in a moment, played a pivotal role in actually catching the Mad Trapper. Without the airplane, he would have got off, could have probably moved to some new area, settled and continued on without anybody knowing his old past. But that's not how it came out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in some ways, when that happened, that closed that door forever. I mean, you can get lost. You can go out to the bus there on, you know, as, you know, what's the book, Krakauer's book?
Into the Wilds.
It's possible to do that, but only by willfully sort of disconnecting yourself. And even that, the helicopter can come looking for you eventually.
Yeah.
And that... I like the story of the Mad Trapper because that's about that pivot point where it changes irrevocably for us in the north.
Okay, so here it is. The Mounties have been notified, and they go out and try to get their man.
Yeah, so he, for reasons we don't understand, he'd sprung some other guy's traps. The Mounties go out to get him. They know where his cabin is. And they get there, the cabin, smoke's coming out of the chimney. They knock on the door. They know he's in there, but he doesn't come out. And that's weird. It'd be weird today, and it was weird then. So they suspect some trouble, and they go back to get reinforcements. When they come back, they want to get him out. He's still there. I mean, and all of this is still by dog mushing. It's the middle of winter, so the Mounties have to go back to – they're going back to Aklavik is where they're going to, talking to the boss. They mush back. So it's about a week cycle time getting in and out to his cabin. But the second time they come there, knock on the door, and they're pretty sure something bad's going to happen, and sure enough it does. He fires through the wall, and he grievously wounds one of the Mounties. At that point, and it's very cold, it's middle of winter, the Mounties do what they need to do, which is get their wounded guy back to Aklavik, where he's actually saved by the surgeons. But now they've got a real problem on their hands. They've got a wacko guy in a cabin, you know, who shot a Mountie. So now they get a lot of reinforcements, including some folks who were alive into the 60s and 70s and have been interviewed. And they head back with a posse, but it's a bitter cold winter. They get to the cabin, and he's still in the cabin. By now, 2 weeks have happened since the beginning. Smoke's still coming out of the cabin, and the standoff starts. But whatever the mad trapper was, he was stone-cold logical about how to hold off the Mounties. His cabin, like many, was partially dug into the dirt, so he was below the grade line, and he must have figured they were coming for him, and a shootout ensues. There's more wounding, and the Mounties again have to back off. When they finally come back, and the standoff ultimately has them dynamiting his cabin, blowing the roof off and stuff, but not actually getting him out of there.
That's so amazing.
Yeah, but ultimately, the mad trapper turns out to be the ultimate hard man from what we can tell. I mean, this guy is sort of superhuman. The Mounties retreat again. When they finally come back, he's finally taken off from the cabin. Of course, the cabin's been blown up. And now there starts this amazing manhunt. From what we can tell, his strategy, the mad trapper's strategy, is to get out of Canada by going over the Richardson Mountains, dropping over into the Porcupine River Basin, which would be near Old Crow today, and heading for Alaska, where there really wouldn't be any extradition-like stuff. But he also seemed to have a plan of sort of circling around the Mounties. They begin to track him, and over a series of times, he does bigger and bigger circles, getting closer and closer to the Richardson Mountains. And I should describe what these look like. This is all taking place in the dead of winter. The Richardsons look in winter, they're nowhere near as tall as our Alaska range, but that's what they look like when you're getting close to them, just huge, white, towering mountains. They finally catch up with him one more time. They don't know how he's keep staying alive. He can't really make fires or anything like that. But anyway, they ambush him, and they get close. But once again, he shows this uncanny ability to survive. He hears they're close. He jumps over a log, and a shootout ensues, and he kills a Mountie. And it gets dark, and it's cold, and the Mounties are scared to get in there because he's such a good marksman. So they come in the next morning, and he's used an axe to cut footholds up the vertical bank behind where he was. They had him pinned down, and he's escaped. And right up till there, it looks like everything's going to go this guy's way, and he's going to get there. But at that point, they've been radioing out. Here's where the technology changes. The Mounties have been radioing out, and it's been making literally broadcast news all across Canada, Alaska, and the Mounties call in Wap May, who's a World War I pilot ace, and its plane. And it flies up to Fort McPherson, and now it starts in the search. As the search goes on, it looks like they've lost him, and then one day the plane's flying and sees tracks going up over the Richardson Mountains. So right there you see, without the aircraft, he gets away, but with the aircraft, they see the tracks. And they realize he's going over the mountains, and the plane flies the Mounties, their dogs, and their sleds, which I kind of find an interesting, ironic thing, flies them up over the mountains and puts them down near La Pierre House in in the Porcupine drainage. And at this point, they're now getting close to the mad trapper. A couple more days ensue where they're finally, they cut his track and the Mounties start closing in. And the ultimate irony is this whole story ends on the Eagle River, a tributary for the Porcupine, where the night before his death, the mad trapper camps on one side of a big bow of the river, and the Mounties are on the other. The mad trapper wakes up that morning, and he heads up river, and he cuts some tracks, and he thinks it's the Mounties who are after him. It turns out it's actually two trappers who live further up the river, and it wasn't the Mounties. He turns around, and he heads back, and, of course, he runs smack into the Mounties who are after him. The amazing thing is this. Right at this time, the aircraft is flying over and, of course, sees this. And the thing that really triggered this for me is at the moment that the shootout occurs and they kill the mad trapper, Wat Mae's flying around and snaps a picture of the scene. So not only does the aircraft, you know, put paid to the idea you can disappear into the north, but the first of the sort of, it's almost like the predator world we're in now, you know, images are, there's images of the actual scene.
Wow.
So I think it's an absolute stunning example of sort of how the North had changed, because the mad trapper could potentially have got away. The other thing that's amazing is all across the North, people were glued to their radios. In Fairbanks, we have accounts. They're listening to this, and I don't know who they were cheering for. I'm not sure. I've seen no accounts to know whether it was the mad trapper they were for or the Mounties. But
well, that guy sure could shoot.
He could shoot. For the listeners, if we've been able to track down his rifle, his snowshoes, I think they're in Winnipeg now in a museum.
Wow. Well, yeah. It's time to take a break, Matt.
Sure.
Our guest is Matthew Sturm. He's the author of Finding the Arctic, and that is but one of hundreds of tales contained in this small book from the University of Alaska Press. It should have been a coffee table book, but nonetheless, it is copiously illustrated. And Matthew, I think what I regret most is that I booked this interview so quickly after I found out about the book, so I had to rush to get through it. And it's the kind of book you want to spend a lot of time with.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, with three locations, including its newest center in Soldotna, offering CT scans, MRI, and digital X-rays to residents on the Kenai Peninsula. Learn more at provimaging.com. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Even as we learn about the place we live in, it's changing right underneath us. 1-800-478-8255 is the telephone number. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about finding the Arctic, and we're concentrating on ground truthing with Matthew Sturm, who actually traced the Arctic Circle on land. And I'd like to bring in at this point also a guest from last year on the show, Higman joins us by phone from Saldovia of Ground Truth Trekking. Hig, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. Aaron's here, too.
Great. Were you able to hear the show? I know we lost some connection some places.
We missed the beginning, but we figured out a different way to listen to it a little ways in.
Way to go, you guys. Aaron, hello to you.
Hello, Steve.
Hi. I wanted to get to... First off, kind of your reactions to Matthew's adventure. You probably have not had a chance to look at the book, but you've got some idea of what they did. These are basically scientists taking scientific observations, but discovering that what they're really interested in is the history that goes along with this geography. of the incredible north across all those barren lands and taiga forest.
Well, I mean, you know, it's really cool. I think, you know, our experience over and over again is you get interested in these questions, and there are a lot of different ways to look at them, you know, and this sort of scientific background, I'm sure, you know, Matt has the same kind of experience, like this great tools for trying to understand something, but there's nothing like going out there and wandering around, and, you know, we often say wandering around like idiots and seeing what you bump into.
Well, you guys have definitely put your bodies into this, and I was trying to tell Matthew a little bit about your adventures with the bears out in the Aleutians.
Yeah, well, there were definitely probably the most bears we've ever ran into were on Unimak Island, but not the scariest one.
And Matthew, you have a bit of experience with that, or have been told about that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was in the Coast Guard, so I'd actually coasted around both coasts of the UMAC, but never saw the bears. But when I was a grad student here, and I wish I could remember his name, there was a young master's student decided he would do his master's degree on the geology of the volcanoes of the UMAC, and he went out there, and I can't remember. They were charged by bears, I know, more than 30 times in the summer, and had at least a dozen near-death experiences, including, like, nearly falling into Westfall Crater. And I don't think that his thesis ever got written, and I always figured he ought to have just written a book about his summer. It just sounded amazing to me. So I'm impressed that you guys hiked around UNIMAC. It's always struck me as an absolutely fascinating-looking place.
Oh, it's an incredible island. I think Aaron was saying that not the scariest bears. We had one very scary encounter just a little ways up the peninsula from there. But we had really just a very surprising number of tense encounters. I mean, we were there for 12 days, I think, walking, something like that. And we had something like four, like, really just, you know, heart-stopping encounters.
Including one bear that destroyed our entire camp.
Huh, okay. Yeah, that's more than just a passing encounter. And these are all brown bears, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. The black bears don't make it out into that kind of country.
Did you make it to Scotch Cap?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can still see the foundation and all the, like, you know, rebar that's been, you know, that was from the foundation is all sheared over and such. It's been pretty weathered at this point too. And there's a monument to the Coast Guardmen who lost their lives in the tsunami 1946. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I that was one of the spots I was interested to see. Going around the island, we came across a few places where there's driftwood way, way up in the tundra. You know, one spot we were at, I think it was over 100 feet up the tundra hills. And I actually, my doctorate was studying tsunamis. I did post-tsunami surveys in the Indian Ocean after the 2004 tsunami, and I worked in other places too. So I was very interested to see that.
Did you get any encounters with the famous Williwaws, the wind, you know, the incredibly strong winds that are associated with UNIMAK Pass?
Well, there's a White Alice site out there. It's just a little north of Scotch Cap. I'm forgetting the name of the cape there, but we had, after our tent was destroyed by the bear, we actually spent basically a whole day stitching. We stitched like 30 feet of tear in the tent, something like that. And it was working all right, but we didn't feel like it was quite as waterproof as it had been originally. And we saw this White Alice site off in the distance, and there was a storm coming in. So we're like, well, you know, I bet you there's some way we can get under shelter there, and we just won't have to worry about, you know, what comes through the tent then. And so we ended up camping in kind of the upper floors of this. There was the only place that wasn't standing water. There's like these giant vacuum tube computers in standing pools of water with like the spooky drips falling like two stories down into the water and stuff.
Man, what a film location that would be.
We were in an old stairwell, and we actually had a friend with us who was a video buff, but his camera had already been killed by the constant mist and salt spray that's all over there.
Were you listening when Matthew was talking about how he had to carry his hard drive?
Well, I missed that. No, but I mean, I know.
Well, I mean,
that
when you're in 20 below and whatnot, it's just not going to work when you take it out and try and work your computers.
Well, what we figured out is that the best thing to do is to have your electronics actually. We would put it in a dry bag that we could hang, like sling over our shoulder, and have it underneath all of our clothes, so it'd actually be against our skin, with the insulation outside of it.
Yeah.
And so then it's always warm, and if you have the dry bag, it doesn't, you know, it's not getting moist against your skin. And then when you pull it out, even if there's a little rain, it's still expelling moisture. And we had very good luck with equipment surviving.
Well, once we start on gear, we'll never end, because we're all
Alaskans here,
and we all want to talk about our gear. but I want to get you back to the Willowa.
Well, yeah, We camped out in this stairwell,
and we built actually a campfire just on the concrete landing near the top, and on this piece of plywood. When we were done with the fire, we just picked up the remains of the fire on this piece of plywood and held it up, and it shot through a hole in the roof and was gone. The whole fire, and we never found it. It flew, the wind was just like. Sucked it up into the air and took it far enough away from the building. We never found any of that wood.
It looked like they'd had some problem with the ductwork when they'd set the building up, and they'd put a lot of it on the outside, like these big elaborate duct systems. And of course, it had been decades, and they'd rusted, and so it became this like giant musical instrument in the wind. It was just the most bizarre, spooky place I've ever been. It was incredible.
Wow, I want to get back to Matthew and his Arctic Circle transect. But first, I did want to check in with Ground Truth Trekking and mention to the listeners that you are continuously updating that website, and now you have all these collaborators out there. It looks like your enterprise has grown quite a bit since the last time we talked about your trip up the Alaska coast.
Yeah, it's been something that's been really fun, because as we do more of these trips, people, some we know already and some we don't, end up finding us who have similar ideas, like, adventures they're going to get out and learn something. And it's been really fun to be able to collaborate and work with all these people.
Yeah, we've been talking about Ground Truth Trekking as a verb,
rather than
an organization, and how do you, that wandering around like idiots kind of thing again. And we've been working with a couple in Homer, Bjorn and Kim, who've done a bunch of wandering around on the Kuskokwim and along the Iditarod, looking at the Donlin prospect, and have a gold mine prospect out there. And now we're talking to a couple college students from Bates who are in Greenland, and got a friend who's walking from Lake Iliamna up to McGrath, along the edge of the Alaska Range through the Revelations there. So anyway, people out there, hopefully learning a lot. And then what we really want to do is to give some opportunity, to help out however we can, help these people share what they experience. Because I think that an adventure, and I think this gets right back to what Matt's been doing, is an adventure is, there's an inherent narrative, that you go out there and you have this experience, and there's a story to tell. There's always, it's always the unexpected. There's always this arc that you got to go from, the beginning to the end of the adventure. And then there's all these things you learn along the way. And those things, in a lot of cases, if that's all you had, it's not much of a story. But it fits together really well, I think. If you've got that narrative adventure, and then you've got all the things you learn along the way. That's a great way to kind of help people learn some interesting stuff.
So you guys really kind of work through a website, and there is writing. Aaron McKittrick does have a book that you've been kind enough not to try and plug, but go ahead and plug it.
So my book is A Long Trek Home, and that goes through our journey from Seattle out all the way to Unimak Island. And I'm actually working on another book right now that'll be out next fall.
Oh, are you going to tell us what it's about?
That one doesn't have, who knows what the title will be. The tentative title is Small Feet, Big Land. And
oh, yeah.
This one includes some adventures with our kids, including 2 months on Malaspina Glacier last fall.
I can hardly wait. I mean, I really look forward to it.
Well, and we also have a movie. So if you're asking us to plug, then
this is the movie. Well, how's that coming along? Because it needed work last time I saw it.
It's out. It's available on DVD, and it actually we won a Banff Award for a shortened version of it. And,
all right.
It's been rattling around. Actually, most recently it was in a Sheffield, England film festival. And I won some shoes. So
good for you. Well, so what's the title?
It's called Journey on the Wild Coast.
And
it's about this journey from Seattle to Unimak again.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thanks a lot, you guys. If you want to stay connected from Seldovia, feel free. But I want to get back to finding the Arctic.
Right. Yeah.
Nice to have met you guys. Good luck with your book and whatever your next trek is.
Yeah, good luck to you, too.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Matthew, you have got... I'm trying to figure out what this is. I got to know you as a scientist. The first time I think I saw you was at a conference, a scientific conference that I had gone to see if it was really true that humans were causing the climate to get warm. And there was a group of scientists who had been to some conference, I think in Arizona, included Mark Serres, Jonathan Overpeck, and you, and you were like the young Turks of this conference, the ones that were coming back from this conference. Said, yes, it is. And I will never forget that.
Yeah, well, for the listeners, professionally, my job by and large is to understand snow cover, and in particular, Arctic and subarctic snow cover and the role it's playing in climate. So for the last 30 years, and now I guess I'm the chief scientist of Krell's Alaska office here in Fairbanks, we've been studying snow cover, and we actually came by these long treks, snowmobile treks, because the satellites don't do all that good a job, unfortunately, in telling us what's happening with snow cover, how it's changing and how it varies spatially, across the landscape. So we found we had to go out there, and while it was fun, and I like the snowmobiling, really it started as just a necessity that for example, if you want to take snow samples and you fly around in a helicopter, it's hard and the weather can be bad and it's actually quite dangerous. It's much, in my mind, much safer to just get out on the ground. So that's actually where these long trips started. And for the listeners who want to know how boring a snowmobile trip can be, imagine driving 5 kilometers or, just a couple miles and stopping and getting off your snowmobile, making a whole bunch of measurements, getting back on, and just when the hand warmers are getting warm, because you've just driven a few miles, you got to stop again. There's an overwhelming desire on these trips to just put the hammer down and screw it and not make your measurements. So we found what we had to do was program them all in advance. We leave with a GPS full of waypoints, and the GPS is boss. It says stop here, and that means you got to stop and make your measurements, because we found that it's almost impossible. It's like trying to go to town but stopping every few miles. You just eventually you feel like you have to drive.
And then what was the part of the deal? Send Huntington out, have him do it.
Well, Henry Huntington has been a wonderful companion on some of these, and not being a geophysicist, we could send him out and we can just look sage and say, Henry, these are really important, and he doesn't question us.
All right. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com. An equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Finding the Arctic is the subject. The telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're talking to people that have made the connection with the land. Did we lose Hig and Aaron? Is that what happened there? Okay, that's good.
I'm still on here.
Okay, Matthew Sturm, who's the author of Finding the Arctic and is a chief scientist now at the Alaska Office of the Army Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory on Fort Wainwright. is with us, and we were kind of talking about climate change because I did want to get some science in here and also to flesh out a little bit who you are, Matthew. But for this book, I have to say, ultimately, this is a travel book.
Yes, absolutely. It's not really science. You know, in my job, I have to write, you know, part of my job is to write papers. We write all sorts of scientific papers. Actually, from the trip, two papers have come out, if someone was interested, a report, and then one that Chris Dirksen, my Canadian partner, and the Traverse did. And the science part of it was quite simply, when the satellites fly over that vast area of central Canada, they were having a lot of trouble interpreting the results because there's so many lakes in the region. And so we were basically doing the ground truth for a set of satellite observations to correct them for the lake factor. And quite simply, when a satellite beam, you know, looks at the signal that's coming up from snow on land, it's quite different from snow sitting on the ice of a lake. And it may not appear that way when you look at the map of Canada, but more than 50% of that barren lands of Canada is water, lakes of various sizes. So, and that worked out quite well. So that was the actual science we were doing on the trip. And, you know, the fun part of that was we were a bit of a SWAT team for science. We would drive along, and then the GPS would say, here's where you have to stop. We'd stop and jump off, and everybody had a role. You know, and we'd get to it. Some guys measuring the depth, other guys, Arvids, would be coring. My job, and the one I enjoy the most, is I dig a snow pit. So I dig a deep hole in the snow, and I begin to look at the layers. And invariably, I'm the sluggard of the group. Everybody else is done and chafing at the bit to leave, and I'm still in my snow pit. So one of the things they do to speed me on my way is they dig the pit for me, because they figure that'll help me get done faster. And then they stand and sort of stare at me while I'm not finished until I realize, okay, we got to finish this up. And then off we go, and we drive a ways, and we do it again.
Matthew, did your editor have to tell you to not to go a little lighter on the snow knife? I mean, you do go on at rather great length about snow knives.
Yeah, I got into snow knives and became very enamored of them. And yeah, someone's cut on that. For those listeners, I probably have the largest collection of snow knives in Alaska now. So for those who don't know, of course, snow knives have been used since the dawn of time, from what we can tell, to shape igloos and stuff. And the old snow knives were bone, and now you can use their metal snow knives. And I love, you know, having a snow knife. You feel a bit like a samurai snow scientist as opposed to just a scientist. It cuts through the nerd factor. So anyway, yeah, they let me keep that in there. The book, though, is not at all for listeners. It's not a science book. What I found I really wanted to do was bring together all these seminal stories that we're starting to lose about the North, you know, like the Mad Trapper or Franklin or Hearn or Matsunabe. You know, when we go through these places and they appear to be wilderness, they're in fact not. There's been tremendous human history, just as your last folks, you know, on
they're back.
On there.
They're back with us,
on UMAC
by the way.
Island, and yeah. Yet, notice the human history, Scotch Cap and the White Alice site loom fairly large in their commentary. I think humans are just fascinated, even in a land that appears to be remote and empty. We're always curious about who's gone before us and what they did and why.
Would you say that, Aaron or Higg?
Well, you know, one of the spots, I absolutely agree, and, you know, one of the spots that really intrigues me is that there's this stretch all the way from Tyonek there, right near Anchorage, all the way to Chignik, this big uh-huh. section of coast where there's no communities now. But that was dotted with communities through, you know, historically. I mean, Kinnatic and...
It's so funny you would bring that up, because Matthew and I all have the same observation. Me from the Appalachian Trail, where there's nobody living or farming along the Housatonic anymore. It used to be an industrial site. And Matthew, you found that, and emptying
Dan
out.
Put that forward in his book, you know, Land Gone Lonesome. I just took a boat trip with John Holmgren, who was on this trip, and our wives, and we boated up the Porcupine. And let's see, here are the villages that no longer exist, but which, you know, you can find relics. Yeah. Burnt Paw, John Herbert Village, Canyon Village, Old Rampart, the second Old Rampart, New Rampart. That's just a handful of the places that used to be vibrant living places on the Porcupine that are not. This is a land where we all live in cities now or tend to, and we have far fewer, you know, the distribution of people is very different than it used to be.
And Prenicke's Cabin is a museum.
Yeah. I'm on your website here, and I see you. I knew Dick Prenicke, and I've stayed with him actually at one time. I haven't got to your pictures, but you know, Prenicke's is a museum rather than a living place anymore.
Yeah, wow. This one from Bruce, Matthew, as you moved across the continent, did you see the high concentrations of snowshoe hare in lynx populations and then lower population patches, like the actual cycle that we know happens?
It was a high lynx year. I'm not a biologist, so if any biologist hears this, you give me some dispensation, but along the lower Porcupine, it was a high lynx year, and some of the trapper families there, the Carrolls in particular, were doing well. That was a really good year for lynx on the lower Porcupine. Upper Porcupine, I don't remember quite as much. The Barren Lands is amazing. It's barren, I guess, for the geology, but it's also pretty barren for animal life as well, in that we saw caribou, occasional snowshoe hare, but not all that much lynx tracks and stuff. So,
you couldn't get the patchiness. But
well, there's a patchy. I was particularly intrigued with the patchiness of ptarmigan. There's currently a lot of interest in ptarmigan as browsing shrubs. This is kind of nips into my scientific area. And
right,
we would hit areas where there were immense numbers of ptarmigan, and then vast areas where there were none at all. And I don't understand that, but it was very notable.
Yeah. Well, I went up to the Arctic Circle and went up to Wiseman, there were all these rabbits that were sitting on the road, and they didn't want to get out of our way or anything. And I asked Jack Rakoff, what in the world is going on with those rabbits? He said, well, it's obvious that they browsed the willow till the willow got toxic to them, and now they got heartburn, and they're getting their milk of magnesia out of that mud on the road. any fool would know that. But, I mean, this is the kind of thing that you only get if you go there. And I think that is the ultimate point of you have to actually – something comes into you when you're breathing a place.
Well, I think – also, there's a hunger in people if they can't go there. To be honest, it's a certain privilege to be able to go there. You have to find yourself in the right situation in life and the right skills. So in that sense, the books and the movies we do are the give back, because there is a hunger for people to experience this, and not everybody can get there for a number of reasons. And so I think we strive in our books to tell that narrative, to tell that story, to get it beyond just a place and have a place with a real sense about it, a history,
right. The
humans.
Yeah.
I know that's what I tried to do in my book. And looking at the website here, it looks like Erin's been trying to do that in hers as well.
Erin, would you say that?
Yeah, definitely.
Good. I want to thank you, Explorers, for being with us again and bringing it on to the radio. Thank you very much, Matthew Sturm, author of Finding the Arctic, and Hig Higman and Erin McKittrick of Ground Truth Trekking.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
And thanks so much to our production crew. It's time to go. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services has over 70 job openings available statewide in nursing, social work, and child protection. There's nothing more important than protecting the health and well-being of Alaska families, so take the first step towards a meaningful career. Visit dhss.alaska.gov and click on Careers. Join their team and make a difference every day. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.